Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, Invasive Candidiasis, the Challenges of Diagnosis and Early Therapy, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Kiran Marr, MD. Dr. Marr is a professor of medicine and oncology, the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, professor of business, the Johns Hopkins Carey Business School, Baltimore, Maryland. Dr. Marr has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. She served as an advisor or consultant for Astellas Pharma, Merck & Company, and Pfizer. She received grants for clinical research from Astellas Pharma, Merck & Company, and Pfizer. Dr. Marr does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Marr does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to empower clinicians to recognize patients at high risk for invasive fungal disease, to minimize the time to treatment initiation, thereby reducing the morbidity and mortality associated with these infections, and provide appropriate and timely diagnosis to support early treatment based on best evidence for patients at high risk for or with invasive candidiasis and other IFDs. This activity is supported by Astellas. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Dr. Kiran Marr. I'm a professor of medicine and oncology at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. I'd like to welcome you to the CME and CE certified activity entitled Invasive Candidiasis, the Challenge of Diagnosis and Early Therapy. Invasive fungal infections have increased in incidence over the last several years. In large part, this has occurred because of changes in hosts. There's been medical progress that has occurred inside and outside of the hospital, and our patients are in general older in age and a sicker population, a large part of them on life-sustaining therapies. We now do a lot more stem cell transplants and organ transplants. We do a lot more intensive chemotherapy for malignancies, and we have many more people alive with HIV and AIDS. And all of this has really led to a change in the epidemiology and an increase in infections. Now, unfortunately, we also have poor outcomes, and this is in large part the infections that are contributing to a direct effect on mortality, as well as the indirect effect of limiting our therapies for the malignancies and underlying diseases. This slide shows the types of invasive fungal infections that are currently the most common in high-risk patients. And as you can see in blue, in large part, the infections are caused by Candida species. And today I'm going to talk about early diagnosis and therapy of Candida infections. We're going to take a case-based approach. Let's start with a 53-year-old man who was admitted to our hospital for necrotizing pancreatitis. And he has pancreatitis because of an extensive history of alcohol use. He was taken to the operating room for debridement, and stents were placed around the pancreatic spaces. The tissue cultures revealed E. coli, and he was started appropriately on piperacillin tazobactam. However, 5 days later, in the surgical intensive care unit, he developed fever, and blood cultures were obtained. The first blood culture, was initially reported as yeasts and potentially Candida species, although it was not identified to the species level. Now, at this point, he was hemodynamically stable, and he had a white blood cell count of 19,000. I'm going to talk about several points that this case indicates. First is that Candida in blood really always requires treatment. I'll discuss the general risks of candidiasis, the limitations of our current culture performance, choosing correct empiric antifungal therapy, and in the end, talk about some new methods that we may be able to use to identify candidiasis early. First, and I think one of the most important teaching points, is that we now need to treat all patients that develop candidemia. Now, historically, there was really quite a lot of controversy over whether or not positive blood cultures actually reflect a real infection or a contamination or potentially a transient infection in which the host could clear the infection, and thus whether this required antifungal therapy. We now know that there are poor outcomes that are largely dictated by secondary disease, such as endocarditis, endophthalmitis, and this has really settled the controversy, and you should understand that all positive blood cultures should be treated even if it appears that the host can rapidly clear that infection. Now, the risks for candidiasis are really multiple, and they have to do with the underlying hosts and other therapeutic variables that predict GI tract colonization with Candida species, as well as the likelihood of acquisition or invasion through the skin, and for the most part, through an intravascular catheter. This slide shows both host factors on the left, as well as medical interventions on the right, that have been shown in multiple different epidemiologic studies to lead to an increased risk for candidal infections, specifically invasive bloodstream candidiasis. The host factors include extremes of age, so the very young as well as the very old, the presence of neutropenia, the presence of renal failure, patients that have high Apache 2 scores, people that undergo extensive burns or have trauma, any reason for bowel perforation, or any reasons that lead to an increased Candida colonization, especially in the GI tract. Some of the medical interventions that lead to increased risk for candidiasis include chemotherapy for cancer, cytotoxic chemotherapy specifically, dialysis, central venous catheters, or nasogastric tubes, prior antibiotic use, because this in large part leads to an increase in Candida colonization in the gut, prior surgery, and that's especially if the surgery involved the abdomen, parenteral nutrition, as well as an ICU stay of greater than 7 days. Now, it's also important when you think about the therapies that we administer to understand that our blood cultures, even though better now than they ever were before, still have limited performance. And the advanced culture techniques currently provide only about a 70% detection sensitivity. And importantly, not all hospitals utilize those advanced culture techniques. To make matters worse, identification of species of Candida actually requires about 2 to 3 days to confirm it. And that's important in order to generate a conclusion with regards to antifungal susceptibility profiles and the appropriate drugs. Now, importantly, the other thing to remember is that negativity is a much more difficult conclusion, and that is because these organisms can grow even up to a week after culture, and in fact, our inability to rule out an infection does justify a lot of our empirical therapies. I think that we can all conclude that we need better methods to diagnose candidemia early and to identify species in positive culture. Now, if we go back to this case, this gentleman's blood cultures were positive for Candida species, but we don't know the species. We do want to start effective treatment early. And so the first question that comes up is, which antifungal drug should we use? Now, the FDA and other agencies have approved multiple different drugs for treatment of Candida. And that includes fluconazole, multiple echinocandins, caspofungin, micafungin, and anidjifungin. The extended spectrum azoles, and specifically voriconazole, has been approved for treatment of candidemia, as well as amphotericin B formulations. And so we obviously have a lot of different drugs to potentially choose from. What we also know is that choosing the right drug is really critically important, because there's a very nice demonstration between the relationship between time to treatment for invasive candidiasis and hospital mortality, such that you can actually see that the mortality, the percent hospital mortality, will increase more than 3 times if there is more than a 12-hour delay in antifungal therapy initiation. So early therapy is really quite important, as is choosing the right drug. It's important to understand which species is likely to be causing infection. And if you look at the largest population-based studies, the most common species that causes infection in this particular patient population is by far Candida albicans, which, as you can see on this graph, constitutes about 62% of the cases of invasive candidiasis that occur right now in the United States. There are other species, however, that are important and potentially of increasing importance, and that includes Candida glabrata, as well as Candida tropicalis and Candida parapsilosis. And those organisms should be treated in different ways. In fact, this table shows the general pattern of susceptibility in Candida species, looking at the species listed in the columns as well as the different drugs, actually, that are across the columns, fluconazole, voriconazole, amphotericin B, and echinocandins. And I think what you can appreciate is that for the most part, Candida albicans is largely susceptible to all of these drugs. And this is with rare exceptions of organisms that can gain resistance to azoles over time. In general, most Candida albicans are susceptible to all of these drugs. Candida glabrata is a little more tricky in that it demonstrates a susceptible dose-dependent or resistance profile to azoles that include voriconazole and fluconazole. Candida tropicalis is much like Candida albicans in retaining susceptibility to most of these drugs. Candida parapsilosis, as we know right now, actually demonstrates a pretty low susceptibility to echinocandins, and so that's a real point that needs to be considered. And the other issue is with Candida krusei, that organism is largely resistant to fluconazole but susceptible to those other drugs, including voriconazole. Keeping these points in mind, you can pretty well guess which drug will be likely to be active against which of the species that's going to be the most common cause of infection. But it's very hard to determine which species is the cause of infection early enough. Now, there are some diagnostic tests that can be used to identify the species earlier. And one is the classic germ tube testing, in which the laboratory tests within a matter of hours whether or not the species of Candida can produce these pseudohyphae, as shown on the right, or some people call them true hyphae. And in that setting, that is really most likely to be Candida albicans. There's another test that is also in use in a number of different hospital laboratories, and that's called the PNA FISH. And that is a test that will tell you within 90 minutes whether the organism is likely to be Candida albicans or Candida glabrata. And so that can be used to employ early therapy as well. This slide summarizes the recommendations for treatment, empirical antifungal treatment, of non-neutropenic patients with suspected invasive candidiasis that was generated by an IDSA consensus group in 2009. An important point taken from that consensus group is that fluconazole can be used in patients that are less critically ill, that have no recent azole exposure. In that setting, you're really predicting that Candida albicans is the likely cause of infection, and that is a susceptible organism. The second point is that echinocandins can be used in patients with moderate to severe illness or recent azole exposure. And all three echinocandins are considered appropriate choices, including caspofungin, micafungin, or nigelofungin. And the third point is that amphotericin B deoxycholate or lipid formulation of amphotericin B can be used when the other antifungals are not tolerated. But most people don't turn to those agents as first-line therapy, where we're typically preferring either azole therapy or echinocandins currently. Let's go back to this gentleman who is our first case. To remind you, he has a case of necrotizing pancreatitis. Candida comes up in his blood culture, and he has 2 days of positive cultures. He was actually treated with micafungin for 5 days, and he became rapidly afebrile. And then he was administered fluconazole for 14 days with surgical drainage of the collection around his pancreas, and is infection resolved. Importantly, he was continued on the drug fluconazole for 14 days after the blood cultures cleared. And again, that's to target any other site that may not be clinically apparent in which Candida is actually causing a secondary infection. He did well. One of the questions that you might ask is whether there are other tests that can be utilized to detect candidal infection earlier. And the exciting answer is yes. Some of these tests have been put out for use that actually rely on detection of antigens rather than culture of Candida species. And the one I will introduce you to is called the 1,3-beta-D-glucan test. And this relies on activation of the limulus amebocyte lysate cascade. It's the same cascade that actually detects endotoxin, but in fact, this actually detects beta-D-glucan, which is a component of Candida as well as multiple other fungi. These tests were actually utilized in Japanese centers for a long time, and they measure beta-D-glucan using a number of different methods to create output. One is a gel coagulability or gel clot method, and there's another chromogenic method. There's one test that is cleared by the FDA and available in the U.S. that actually relies on detection or relies on a chromogenic method to detect beta-D-glucan in patients' blood. This test has been studied in a number of different patient populations, and the first population that was studied were high-risk patients with myelodysplastic disorders and leukemia. The one thing to keep in mind is that the tests may not be the same from study to study or from country to country because they use different reagents, notably because there are different types of horseshoe crabs that are utilized to recover those reagents. And so the tests are different when they utilize different horseshoe crabs. But there have been several studies, and in the at-risk leukemic population, this was a study in which 283 neutropenic subjects had seven sera that were obtained over a three-week period of time, constituting over 2,000 samples. And as you can see with the table, the positive predictive value and the negative predictive value of detecting either proven or probable invasive fungal infection in the presence of three or greater serum samples was quite high, with a positive predictive value of 80% and a negative predictive value exceeding 90%. Now, this diagnostic test has actually also been evaluated just this year, largely in intensive care unit patients. And the question that this particular study addressed that was just published in the Journal of Clinical Microbiology in 2011 was, do serial measurements of beta-glucan support the clinical diagnosis of invasive candidiasis in patients that are in the surgical intensive care unit? And in this study, they evaluated 239 samples that were obtained from 57 patients. And in that population, 26% of the patients were actually considered to have either a proven invasive candidiasis infection or a possible infection. Now, the presence of the possible infection category here in evaluating the outcomes is an important caveat because, in fact, possible infection isn't proven infection. So that's an important thing to keep in mind and a potential limitation of this study. But the results that they generated in this rather large analysis are shown in the table in that proven or probable infection, the sensitivity of the assay with greater than three samples was 63% and the specificity 73%. And in that setting, there were positive results of the assay that were actually obtained before the culture generated the organism. So there really may be a possibility of actually giving the drug or an antifungal drug in a preemptive strategy with the presence of the beta-glucan assay coming up positive. And it's because of these results there that these authors concluded that a high-risk screening strategy, in other words, obtaining serial samples on patients that are known to be at high risk, and then employing an antifungal that should be effective preemptively may be a good way to prevent the disease progression in the surgical intensive care unit patients. Now, there's a couple caveats with regards to these diagnostic tests, and one is that there may be a certain amount of problems with false positivity. The specificity has actually been shown to be rather low in hospitalized patients that include neutropenic patients or ICU patients, even in healthy blood donors that had almost an 8% false positive test result in some of these studies. There appears to be an association with hemodialysis and specifically with cellulose membranes that are used for hemodialysis, gauze contamination by surgery, intravenous immunoglobulins, and maybe some other bacterial infections can actually lead to some false positive results. I think it's important to keep in mind that glucan actually may be found in many different things, including many other treatments. And in fact, some antibacterial drugs can have a certain amount of contaminated glucan, and the drugs that have been found to actually result in a positive beta-glucan test in vitro are shown on this slide. There are different types of patients that we have to consider, and so here I'd like to switch from case one to another patient. And this is a very different type of patient. This is a 73-year-old lady with a history of rheumatoid arthritis and a myelodysplastic syndrome that's progressed to AML. And she's currently day 20 after her treatment for AML with the drugs that are listed there. She's being given prophylaxis with levofloxacin and valacyclovir. However, 7 days into treatment, despite the prophylaxis, she developed a fever to 38.5, and her levofloxacin was switched to piperacillin tazobactam. Now, unfortunately, 2 days later, her fever progressed, and she developed this rash shown here. Very small and tender erythematous papules is largely what she developed all over her body, but largely in her forearms, more so than everywhere else, so the lesions were apparent elsewhere. At this point, she had an absolute neutrophil count of zero. Her creatinine was 0.8, and so her kidneys were working pretty well, and blood cultures came up rapidly positive for Candida tropicalis. Now, this is a classic neutropenic patient that develops candidal infection and disseminated candidiasis very quickly. And it's important that we understand the nuances in treating neutropenic patients differently than the intensive care unit patients. Neutropenia actually by itself does not lead to increased risks of infection. It requires a breakdown of anatomic barriers such that most of the patients who develop disease actually do develop disease that disseminates through their GI tract. Patients, however, with neutropenia may have different mechanisms of disease, either dissemination through their GI tract or through their skin, and they actually may have worse outcomes. It's interesting, though, when you look at the treatment guidelines for candidemia, you can see that they're actually classified according to the presence or absence of neutropenia. I actually don't think that this is necessarily the relevant variable. I think the mechanism of infection is the most relevant variable, even though neutropenic patients actually do worse in outcomes models. It's important, though, to understand the pathogenesis that leads to the disease risk. As I said, the importance of neutropenia per se is actually questionable, and some of the things that we're learning about this are actually coming out of some really neat setup animal models in which they've found that breakdown of neutrophils themselves or presence of neutropenia does not lead to infection without a breakdown in barriers and transmission through the GI tract. So the risks are actually disruption of the ecologic as well as the anatomical barriers. It relies on breakdown of anatomic barriers, largely in this patient population being the GI tract. Elimination of bacterial competitors, that's where your other antibiotics come into the mix by eliminating all of those organisms that are good players in the gut. And immune defects themselves that lead to rapid dissemination. And in fact, the immune defects are not well understood. One of the big questions that comes up a lot is, why do so many people who have these risks, GI tract breakdown and neutropenia, never develop candidemia. And it's actually interesting. It's probably because there are genetic polymorphisms that encourage GI tract colonization that we're just starting to appreciate now. What we do know as well from large outcome studies is that these patients usually do poorly. And this is a Kaplan-Meier survival analysis 12 weeks after infection with multiple different species of Candida. And this comes from a data set of over 2,000 patients that developed candidemia in the United States between the years 2004 and 2008. And you can see by looking closely at this slide that the patients that do the worst were the patients that developed Candida krusei infections, that's the lowest bar, as well as Candida tropicalis. It's very difficult to make any conclusions with regards to virulence of the organism because, in fact, the patients who were the sickest also develop Candida krusei infections. Suffice it to say that the outcomes are very, very poor, and so we really should be asking the very important question of how we can avoid this complication or candidemia from the start. And this slide actually shows all of the preventative antifungal approaches that we classically think about. It includes prophylaxis or given a drug during a certain period of time that's considered to be high risk in this type of patient during a period of neutropenia. Empirical therapy or treating a fever when no other source of the fever is documented. As well as a preemptive strategy in which you rely on detection of some kind of component of the fungus, either from a positive antigen result or from a PCR result. By far, the largest studied area is in prophylaxis currently, where a lot of different drugs are being evaluated with regards to their ability to prevent fungal infections, candidal infections, as well as other fungal infections. And I would just say that in general, this is a very successful approach. But success really relies on a balance, the balance between doing a good thing and preventing the infection and potentially doing a bad thing and introducing a drug that can lead to other drug toxicities, liver toxicities or kidney toxicities, as well as the drug interactions that ultimately result in that balance. There are, however, multiple drugs that are accepted as reasonable therapy for a prophylactic indication. And this slide just summarizes the IDSA guidelines. Again, the Infectious Disease Society of America consensus group on treating and preventing candidal infections. And it's broken down between host state. And in general, neutropenic patients do actually have a good outcome with a prophylactic therapy, and giving prophylactic antifungals, posaconazole, fluconazole, or micafungin is considered to be an A1 indication or supported by large randomized trials, especially in patients that have received a hematopoietic stem cell transplant, specifically and especially allogeneic stem cell transplants. In the chemotherapy setting, and that is admittedly a very heterogeneous group of patients, multiple drugs have again been studied that include fluconazole, posaconazole, or caspofungin, and they are considered to be good, efficacious, and rather safe at preventing candidal infections. The other population that's been studied is in the neonatal intensive care units, and in that setting, fluconazole given to a high-risk population, less than 1,000 grams, and in units that have particularly high rates of candidal infections, is thought to be supported by good randomized data. The other two populations are a little bit more controversial, although there are some larger studies as well, that in liver, pancreas, and small bowel transplant recipients. In other words, in those patients in which there's been a surgical disruption in the GI tract, they have high rates and risks for candidal infections, and both fluconazole and lipid formulations of amphotericin B at low doses have been studied and shown to be effective at preventing candidal infections. And the last population is just like our first case, and that's in the adult intensive care unit. In that setting, fluconazole, specifically prophylaxis, is thought to be a B1 indication in populations that are, have a high risk, as well in units that have high rates of infections. Some units use it, some units don't. There are a lot of different practice patterns with regards to antifungal strategies in intensive care units. But those are the conclusions from the consensus group. So here I'm going to summarize. I'm going to bring out multiple different points that I think are the most important things to think about in early treatments and diagnosing candidal infections. And I think the most important is Candida is really always something that requires treatment, even if it appears as if the host has transiently or has cleared that infection. You don't know where else the Candida has caused a secondary infection or a nidus that may become apparent later on. The general risks for infection include breaches in the skin as well as the GI tract, and then everything that leads to an increase in GI tract colonization. It's important to understand our limitations of culture performance. They're better than they used to be, but they're not 100% perfect. And this is the observation that really suggests that we do need to employ empirical therapy and early treatment in people that have high risks. Choosing the right empirical antifungal therapy in suspected cases requires you to think about what species would be the most common in that setting. However, some of the new non-culture-based methods also allow us to potentially identify invasive candidiasis cases earlier. The utility there is not entirely clear, and a lot more randomized trials need to be done. I think that prophylaxis should be considered in patients with very high risks because ultimately preventing disease in this setting proves to be the best thing that you can do. Thanks for participating in this activity. To proceed to the online CME test, click on the Earn CME credit link on this page. Thanks very much.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, Invasive Candidiasis, The Challenges of Diagnosis and Early Therapy. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.